Today, we head to Guantanamo Bay, where, almost 18 years after 9/11, no one has been brought to justice. And Damien Carrington on the dramatic decline in insect numbers. The Guantanamo Bay detention camp was established in the months after September the 11th, 2001, when almost 3,000 people were killed in the worst ever terrorist atrocity on American soil.
This just in, you were looking at obviously a very disturbing live shot there. That is the World Trade Center, and we have unconfirmed reports this morning that a plane has crashed into one of the towers.
Another one just hit the building.
Wow. The whole building just came apart.
Oh, holy smokes.
Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center in an apparent terrorist attack on our country, and have ordered that the full resources of the federal government go to help the victims and their families, and to hunt down and to find those folks who committed this act.
The government argued that the prison on a U.S. naval base on the southern tip of Cuba was outside the remit of American law.
Donald Rumsfeld, who was then Defense Secretary, wanted somewhere to store captives so that they could be interrogated out of the reach of US law.
Among those detained there are Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the self-proclaimed mastermind of 9/11. And yet, almost 18 years after the attacks took place, arguably the most important criminal trial in American history has yet to begin. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, will justice for 9/11 ever be served in Guantanamo Bay? Before we start, I'd like to warn you that this piece includes descriptions of torture. Two weeks ago, The Guardian's World Affairs editor, Julian Borger, travelled to Guantanamo Bay to attend a pre-trial hearing in the case of five men accused of planning the 9/11 attacks.
Pretty much everyone going for a 9/11 hearing has to go the same way. You have to go to Andrews Air Force Base very early in the morning. When you board the plane, you're all called in turn. You're called media, then NGOs, observers, prosecution, then defence, then VFMs, which is victim family members. We all get on the plane together. You land at an airstrip on one side of the bay, where pretty much the only thing there is the airstrip and some swamps and mangrove. You get on a military ferry that takes you across the beautiful blue bay, and you can look up into the mountains, which is Cuba proper, and the base itself is just this strip of land around the bay. The military commissions themselves, the courtroom, is a fenced off compound. It's got sort of anti-sniper netting all around it, with razor wire all around it, and with bright lights at night.
Where does everyone stay when they're there?
Everyone housed in these tents, row and row of tents that looks like a military camp. They're kept like a refrigerator inside. There's air conditioning going on all the time. The sound of this air conditioning is, you know, one of the loudest sounds on the island, a reminder of how much this whole operation costs.
Julian, this year will mark 18 years since 9/11. I think people will be really surprised to know that you were there, not even for a 9/11 trial, but for a 9/11 pre-trial hearing.
Yes, I mean, I think it's what struck me, that we're still in pre-trial hearings. There are lots of reasons for it. At heart, it is because the US administrations over those 18 years have not really been able to make up their mind what to do with these prisoners. And part of the reason is it's because they started off by torturing them. And that has complicated everything.
I mean, I understand that and I can see the complexity, but 18 years, has anyone been brought to justice for 9/11 in that time?
Not through the military commissions, no. So the military commissions, in terms of delivering justice, have a very poor record.
So you're there in this courtroom. Families of the victims are also there. Were you able to speak to any of them?
Yes, we were, but only through a sort of negotiated process. They have their own minder who basically runs a lottery that they enter. When their number comes up, they have a paid trip to come over. And there are about half a dozen of them, all accompanied by someone they have chosen to go with them to keep them company. So they sit in the observation room, in the gallery, behind three panes of glass separating them from the courtroom. We asked to talk to them, and only two came to agree to talk to us. We were about half a dozen journalists there. And one of them, the mother of one of the victims on board United 93, was full of bitterness about Islam in general, but most of all about what she called the liberal media.
My son, Mark Bingham, was one of the fellows that stood and fought Islamist terrorists aboard hijacked United Airlines Flight 93. I wish that, for obvious reasons, I wish that Mark were here today, but I don't think that he would understand or approve of what's going on down here.
Furious. All the anger that she had about the loss of her son, how long this had taken, the absence of any kind of justice so far, really she directed at us, the liberal media.
Did it affect how you thought about things that day, the fact that she confronted you?
I think it brought home to me the very depth of grief and pain that the surviving family members go through. Now, the other mother who came to see us was very much the opposite. She is also consumed with grief. Her name was Kathy Powell, and her son, Scott, was a contractor working in the Pentagon when the plane hit that side of the Pentagon, and by some horrible fluke, he was the only person in that office to be killed. And she used to live in Washington and said that she tried to carry on living in Washington after it.
And I had to move from Washington, D.C. because I couldn't deal with just walking where my son walked.
I couldn't bear treading in his footsteps. Now lives in Georgia. And this was her first time coming. She said she wanted to come because she just could not understand why it was taking so long. And I think she left really not much the wiser.
And Kathy Powell, who you're talking about, she's 85 and in fragile health. I mean, does she think she'll see this case through?
I don't think she has that confidence that she will be still around to see this through. I think, if the pre-trial proceedings take this long and the trial is not yet on the horizon, those would be high odds against surviving to the end of this process.
I want justice. I think that it's gone on too long, and they admitted to the guilt. And so why can't we get over with it?
Can you tell us about the defendants?
Well, the defendant number one is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is self-proclaimed mastermind of the 9/11 attacks.
The alleged mastermind of the 9/11 attacks on the U.S. has been denied the right to be tried in a civil court.
And I remembered him most from the photograph taken at his arrest in all the way back in 2003 in Pakistan, where he looks like a chubby guy, overweight, in a white vest, kind of bleary-eyed and angry. He looks nothing like it now. He's in long white robes. He's grown this enormous bushy beard that he has dyed orange with henna. Usually he appears in a camouflage jacket. He didn't this time. Came out in white robes and an Afghan wool cap. You see him first, this entrance he makes on the side of the court with two guards on either side of him with a hand on each shoulder, and the guards in blue latex gloves as they guide him to his seat. And he sat down and starts chatting very amiably with his defense team. And then a few minutes later, you get the number two accused.
Waleed bin Attash, who allegedly selected and trained some of the 19 hijackers.
Waleed bin Attash, who is alleged to have run an al-Qaeda training camp in Afghanistan, the Logar camp. That's where two of the 9/11 hijackers were trained. And he was also slated to be one of the hijackers, but wasn't able to get into the U.S. Number three was Ramzi bin al-Shib.
Ramzi bin al-Shib tried four times to get a visa to enter the U.S., but was denied each and every time. Instead, he became the primary coordinator of the attacks.
He's a Yemeni who's accused of organizing the logistic for the attack. Also was due to be one of the hijackers, but also couldn't get into the U.S. The fourth is Ammar al-Baluchi, who is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's nephew.
Ammar al-Baluchi was the model for the character Ammar in the movie Zero Dark Thirty.
And is also alleged to have played a critical role in organizing, getting the logistics, organizing for the hijackers' flight school training in the U.S. The last is a Saudi called Mustafa Ahmed al-Hassawi, who is accused for being a fixer for the 9/11 plot. He is significantly more frail than the other four. He limps in and he carries with him a sort of oversized box-like cushion that he puts on his chair before he sits down. And that's because he was subjected while in CIA black sites to very intrusive, forceful rectal exams, which his lawyers say was just a form of torture. Basically, he was sodomized and is in very poor health as a result.
Now, Amnesty International says Mustafa al-Hawsawi is in desperate need of medical care. The rights organization speculates that the Saudi inmates' physical problems have been the result of torture at the hands of the CIA.
He comes just for the first session of each hearing because that's obligatory, and then is taken back to the camp where he spends most of his time bedridden.
I mean, as you've pointed out, they've all been tortured, and we're going to talk more about that. Did they seem to you totally broken by years in the camp without trial?
Al-Hassawi did. I mean, the others do not give outward signs of being broken men. They are fairly feisty. Ramzi bin al-Shim spoke up and challenged the judge's authority at one point. Bin Attash refuses to have anything to do with his defense team, will not recognize them. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed comes across as someone very relaxed and kind of interested in the proceedings. So they don't come across as being traumatized, but their defense lawyers said that once you've gone through that kind of trauma, it never goes away. And this is an issue very much at the heart of the proceedings in Guantanamo Bay, is what was the effect of 3.5 years of torture on CIA black sites on the testimony they gave on arriving in Guantanamo Bay? Is that testimony tainted by that traumatic experience?
You've talked a bit about it, but to what extent do we know what scale and type of torture was used?
Well, the main form of torture used, the most severe, was waterboarding.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was strapped to a board, tilted head down, a cloth placed over his face, and water poured over his mouth to give the sensation of drowning.
Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is known to have been waterboarded on 183 different occasions. The other defendants also subjected to waterboarding, also other forms of what they called at the time enhanced interrogation techniques involving stress positions, sleep deprivation, and so on.
I mean, what I don't understand here is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is the self-proclaimed mastermind of 9/11. By using these techniques, aren't they reducing, perhaps, the chances of bringing justice to him?
Yes, absolutely. And this is the fact of torture is the huge obstacle, a barrier between where we are now and a full trial. If he'd gone straight to federal court after capture, still full of himself, still, you know, crowing about his central role, he would have been convicted and would have been in a federal penitentiary, if not, you know, facing the death penalty within a matter of months. But it is this issue of torture, which was motivated by this sense at the time that there were more attacks out there and these captives had to be milked for all and every morsel of intelligence that they had. But of course, the irony is that many experts on interrogations on torture say that it is not effective.
So the really strange thing is that we've heard of the FBI and possibly the CIA interrogating the defense teams about their relations. Why? What were they suspicious of?
Well, they see it as part of the counter-terrorist effort. And so anyone, for them, anyone who has contact with these suspected terrorists and they're maybe are helping communication between them and the outside world, which is just the nature of what defense teams do, is immediately under suspicion.
So to be a defense lawyer in a hugely high-profile and complicated case like this comes at a pretty big personal cost.
The lead defense lawyer for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, David Nevin, said that he's been under investigation or threat of investigation 9 times.
There are many frustrations and there's much to suggest that it would be better not to be involved. But I think it's important to see it through.
He's had to hire his own attorney on several of these occasions. And the more elderly of the defense counsels like Nevin, some of the others, said it's okay for us. We're coming towards the end of their career. But the younger civilian and military defense counsels on their team have been asking, can I get out of this? Because it's going to ruin my career. And so you have a big turnover in these defense teams. And you also have people coming in that appear to have been plants by the FBI, moles put in their defense teams to spy on what they're doing.
And tell us about some of the things that happened while you were there that perhaps delayed the procedure.
Well, when we got there, the defense teams were beginning to drop like flies from this terrible flu that spread amongst them, maybe on the plane. And so the first to go down was one of the military counsels. But then the lead counsel for Bin Attash was also really badly hit by this flu and had to struggle her way up to the bench. It was obviously a struggle for her even to speak. But if she wasn't there, the whole case would grind to a halt and would have to be adjourned. So she brought herself in. And then a third one went down and suddenly in the middle of proceedings called for the judge's attention and said, I have to leave, and kind of ran out of the courtroom and was away for about half an hour. But it underlined the very fragility of these proceedings. So the judge, through all this, was trying to push proceedings on. But the irony was, at the end of the second day of hearings, he called defense and prosecution counsel into his chambers, announced to them that he would have to be evacuated off the island because he had a detached retina. And now that this issue of his fitness to conduct a trial hangs over the rest of the proceedings.
I mean, obviously, people can't help being ill, but it sounds bizarre, shambolic. I mean, has this been the case before this particular proceeding?
Yes, it has. One of the defense counsels broke her arm on one occasion, and that led to a holdup. If this was going on the U.S. soil, you would have a kind of bench of defense lawyers, and if one was ill, the other one would step in, and the procedure would go on. But this is a much more fragile, it's much thinner ice. One goes down, then everything grinds to a halt.
So it's just been dogged by problems with health, procedure, and above it all, problems of politics. I mean, with the changing presidency of the United States, that has also caused this process to be delayed.
Yes, that's right.
In the meantime, Gitmo has become a symbol around the world for an America that flouts the rule of law.
Because Obama wanted to close it down, he wanted it in federal court. All the charges were dropped in 2010 in expectation that the whole trial would be transferred to a federal court. But because of opposition in Congress, that didn't happen. And so the whole process had to begin again with the military commissioners recharging all the defendants. So between 2008 and 2010, 2011, when it finally got going again, nothing was happening. The whole process was frozen. And now you have Trump coming in saying, yeah, we love Guantanamo and we may be bringing more inmates there.
To re-examine our military detention policy and to keep open the detention facilities in Guantanamo Bay.
So, Julian, what happens now? When will the trial actually start?
Well, we know it won't start before 2020, but I think even 2020, looking at this procedure as we witness this week, is very optimistic. And torture is on trial alongside the defendants in Guantanamo. And that has not been resolved.
And I really understood the mother's fury when she confronted you and she was angry with the liberal media. But there's another side of justice as well. We've got people here who are being held without trial, who faced years of torture. And there is a sense that for America, they're denying people a fair trial.
Absolutely. It is for anyone steeped in the US legal tradition. What is going on is anathema. And let's not forget that altogether there are 12 inmates in Guantanamo who have charges laid against them or who are about to have charges laid against them. The rest of the 40 are detained with no legal procedure whatsoever, not even pretrial hearings. And five of those number have been cleared of any responsibility for 9/11. But there is nowhere for them to go. They are still there years afterwards. So in a way, the five that we saw in their pretrial proceedings over the past week are, in a sense, the lucky ones. They have a legal process, but the others are just in limbo. There is no prospect of them going anywhere.
Julian, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can read Julian Borgia's report at theguardian.com. Coming up, insects could vanish within a century at the current rates of decline. This will have catastrophic consequences for both the planet's ecosystem and for the survival of mankind, according to The Guardian's environment editor, Damien Carrington. Welcome back. Now Damien Carrington on what is causing the collapse of insect populations.
When I found the paper, I was excited because I'm really interested in what's happening with the insects, and this is the first global review that's been done. And then when I started reading it, I was thinking, oh my God. In particular, the language is really strong. And in scientific papers, they tend to be really calm. But this just didn't do that. It talked about, you know, the threat of catastrophic collapses of ecosystems. And that's because insects are so important to all aspects of life on Earth. So how fast are insects declining? Well, the scientists looked at the very best studies that were available and calculated that the weight, the mass, if you like, of insects is falling by about 2.5% every year. 2.5% may not sound very much, but actually, if Professor Francisco Sanchez-Bello told me that in 10 years' time, you'll have a quarter less insects. In 50 years, only half left. And in a century, you'll have none. And that's pretty shocking, should it come to pass. I do write about this a lot, and it's very clear that we're in the beginning, at least, of a sixth mass extinction. But even so, you do get a bit of a slap in the face when you start looking through. So insects are essential to pretty much all the ecosystems on Earth, that is, these networks of life, so everything's interrelated. The most obvious thing that insects provide is food. You know, lots of birds and fish and lizards and so on feed on insects, and other animals feed on those. If you don't have them, they starve. Simple as that. Pollination, of course, is incredibly important. Every flowering plant requires pollination, and that's about 75% of all the crops that we eat. Insects are also nature's great recyclers. So, you know, from dead animals to dead wood, they break this stuff down and turn it back into nutrients which can be used by plants. So they're really an integral part of the cycle of life. There's about a million of them, a million different species. And actually, if you could capture all the insects and weigh them, they'd be about 17 times heavier than all of the 7 billion humans on Earth. There's a lot of insects. In the last couple of years, there's been some very striking findings. So in Germany, they found that 75% of flying insects had disappeared in about 25 years. And that was in nature reserves. And then last year, there was a terrifying report from Puerto Rico where a scientist had gone back after 35 years and in terms of the ground insects had found that they'd gone down by 98%. And so those two things have really woken people up. But in this case, with this new paper, what they found in terms of headline is that 40% of species are declining and 30% of those are declining very rapidly and they're therefore threatened with extinction. Yeah, it's incredibly serious and worrying. You know, everybody you talk to who knows about these areas are really, really frightened about what could happen if things don't change very rapidly. So this apparent collapse of insects all around the world seems to have a number of causes. One of the principal causes is the intensification of agriculture. So the growth of agriculture has got rid of some wild places, but the intensification, which means stripping out, you know, hedgerows and copses, is a problem, plus the widespread use of insecticides, particularly over the last 20 to 25 years. In the tropics, where increases in temperature that have come with global warming seem to have had a really, really bad effect. So the situation looks really bad, but there are things which could be done. They require huge changes in the way that we live, produce food, so industrial, chemical-based, large-scale farming would need to change. Anything we can do to reduce climate change is really important. So eating less meat and dairy, flying less. You know, there is an annihilation of wildlife, not just insects, but pretty much all species going on across the planet. In terms of the bigger animals, their populations have fallen by about 60% since 1970. So it's really catastrophic, and I think that politicians are becoming more aware of that. But I think insects have pretty much flown under the radar. We'd certainly miss them if they were gone.
That's all for today. My thanks to Julian Borger and Damien Carrington. Today's episode was produced by Lucy Greenwell, Mithili Rao and India Rakesson. Sound design was by Axel Kukutier.